Hey, everybody. Welcome to Defy. This is a podcast about stories, because everyone has a story to tell. We're all about sharing stories of women and non-binary individuals and how they have defined the odds, persevered through incredible circumstances, and transformed their lives. Is this a show about perfection? No, because it doesn't exist. Is this a show full of empty self-help quotes for you to put on your Instagram? No, that is not our style. This is a show about breaking the rules, creating your own path, and being your true self. Because remember, well-behaved women rarely make history. Non-binary folks excel at breaking models. So come on, let's get out there and defy. We're doing this, Allison. This is happening right now. This is happening.
Okay.
So I am very excited about my podcast guest today for Defy because she is a good friend of mine. And interestingly enough, and I don't know if you feel the same way too, Allison, we've become better friends during COVID than pre-COVID. Like, yes. We knew each other. We both served on a board together. We, you know, had things in common, like our love for dogs, and also the fact that, you know, we both love behavior analysis. Obviously, you have a PhD in behavior analysis. We both love the type of work that we do. We have so much energy for our field, and you are a tremendous, you know, public speaker. You know, not only an educator, you know, a part-time professor, a clinician, you're all the things. But it's been, we've had a really interesting personal journey together during COVID because it's been something that's been challenging for both of us. And I remember when I first talked to you about coming on this podcast, you were like, no.
That is very true. It was definitely something far outside of my comfort zone. And like the first thing that we did together was some webinars for the organization that we serve on. And that I thought was super scary at first because you had like all this professional lighting and everything. And I'm just sitting here in my kitchen, like with my no microphone or anything. And I just think that we have really good energy that feeds off of each other. So, but the podcast, speaking a lot more personally, definitely something that terrified me when you first mentioned it to me, and yet here I am. Yeah.
I'm so proud of you. And what I promised you through this experience, because this has been my experience, and it, literally this is the same feedback that I've received from everyone that's been on this podcast, is it is a deeply freeing experience to be able to talk about your story, to be able to talk about the things that are, you know, closest to your heart, deeply personal, as a way to almost release yourself of some of the burden and also allow and kind of normalize the conversation that we're going to have that likely so many other people are experiencing and maybe just didn't know that they could use their voice in that way, didn't know that they could talk about things. And so I'm really grateful for that. And thank you. I've just been so proud of you, especially over these last like few months. And I'm just really, I believe strongly, and we talked about this last week when we were prepping for this podcast, I very, very much believe strongly that what we are going to talk about today could potentially save someone's life. And I know that you and I are both, you know, we're in a helping profession. We believe deeply and passionately about serving others. And so this is a different type of service than you are used to, but aligns so closely with your values and who you are. And so I think as we continue to talk, it'll be easier than perhaps you thought.
I hope so.
You're like, or I'm just going to have like two shots of tequila afterwards and call it a day.
that may happen as well. But like you said, I think what really motivated me to commit to doing this with you is that I do think my story is something that can help other people. And that's really why I'm doing this, is to talk about these, having this conversation of these difficult topics that I think more people relate to than anyone knows or necessarily wants to admit, especially in the midst of the pandemic and how that has tremendously affected everyone. And not just on a physical level, but the mental health level is really what I'm going to be talking about and how that has affected so many people. And it's such an important topic for us all to talk about.
Yeah, I agree. So before we talk specifically about what transpired for you with COVID, you and I, again, had had a chance to meet and talk about this last week. Yes. We wanted to provide just some context for people listening. Because obviously you have a PhD, you know, this highly successful career, and you have two chronic mental illnesses. So can you first identify what are the two chronic mental illnesses that you have been working through?
Yes. So I have struggled since I was a child with major depression and generalized anxiety, as well as also obsessive compulsive disorder, kind of tie them together into generally having chronic anxiety conditions. And they present a little bit differently, but they are, again, these are things that I have struggled with my entire life. Even as a young child, I remember having a lot of anxiety and fear, having some compulsive behaviors, like skin picking is something I've struggled with my whole life and continue to work on not engaging in that behavior as much. As a child, I also had a lot of stomach aches and headaches, which I came to learn later on that those are actually really common indicators of mental distress in children. Because as we know, children do not necessarily have the verbal capacity to explain exactly how they're feeling, especially when you have something as intense as more debilitating anxiety or depression. As a young child, it's very hard to express that. And I was also very quiet and studious. And I think you and I talked about that as well, that it was kind of like, I was always that straight A student. I also did theater very actively in community theater. And I think that those things kind of helped me to be able to function as a child and teen and be able to succeed, even though internally I really did struggle many, many years as a child and teen. And I even remember like feeling very depressed and like not necessarily even wanting to live anymore when I was like in middle school. And that's a pretty young age. And I just really didn't know how to handle any of these feelings or who to seek help from or really what to do. And again, I think because I was a good student and I never caused any trouble at school or anything like that, it just wasn't really obvious to other people, other adults in my life, that I was someone who was struggling.
Yeah. And you were saying that you, the first really clear memory that you have of being depressed or anxious was when the Northridge earthquake happened when you were age six. So can you kind of describe for people that aren't familiar with that earthquake, that's something that happened in LA, it was pretty major. And what what did you do in response to that?
Yeah, exactly. It's really interesting because I do kind of, that is one of my earliest memories and something that I really do attribute a lot of my initial anxiety and fear to. So I was in the sixth grade, in the kindergarten. In January 1994, there was a very large earthquake here in the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles. And it was in the middle of the night, and I woke up to the shaking. Furniture was falling in my house. My mom was screaming. Her and my dad were coming to get me and my sister, who was only three. And I remember the shaking being for a pretty long time. And then I remember my family and all of our neighbors at our old house in West Hills. We went into the middle of the street and people were concerned, like, are the houses going to fall down? And, you know, as a young child hearing all of this, and I do believe I already had a, you know, susceptibility to anxiety and fear. It kind of just escalated my nervousness. And there were a lot of aftershocks. And my elementary school was also closed for a few weeks, maybe. I don't remember exactly how long. So I was staying home, and every time there would be an aftershock, I would really not want to be separated from my mom. I didn't want to be alone. I didn't want to sleep in my own room. And I really think that a lot of other fears started to develop after that through the rest of kindergarten and into other elementary school years. And I struggled a lot throughout grade school with the fear of earthquakes. And every time there would be any earthquake, even a very small one, I would end up sleeping on the floor of my little sister's room or sleeping in my parents' room, just not feeling comfortable being alone. And just a lot of fear that the house would fall or something would happen and we would be stuck or we would be hurt or something would happen to my family.
And then another thing that we talked about was in fourth grade, for example. So again, for people to understand this, like, Allison is super smart. You know, she's like, this was a straight A student, never forgot anything, got everything, you know, high achieving, but you got benched in fourth grade. And I remember getting benched once, like in elementary school. And this, you know, for a 10-year-old, this is like the end of, like, especially for kids like us that were like rule governed kids. Yes. This is like the end of life, right? You got benched for forgetting your homework. So it's not that you didn't do the homework. Of course you did the homework, but you forgot it. And so you were given this punitive punishment despite having done it. And this started this like compulsiveness with checking your backpack to make sure like your homework was there.
And exactly.
So this, you know, and it's so interesting, like in education and from a behavior analytic perspective, likely now, you know, what could have been a more compassionate response by your teacher was say, Allison, you know, I understand that you did it and you forgot it, and maybe I'm going to deduct like a partial point for this, but I'll give you the opportunity to turn it in. So it's not this like horrible experience, but you know, like, I mean, this is often in education, we don't choose the thing that allows kids to scale, build and feel successful. We engage in a lot of punishment, and this was this, you know, like traumatizing experience for you. And so, you know, the negative self-thoughts, the low self-esteem, the compulsive behaviors, you were, you know, we were talking about also led to some adaptive traits that actually helped you in your education and, you know, career goals. You're super punctual, you're organized, you're detail oriented, you're hardworking. And I see so much of myself in this story, that you're telling about your, you, because I do the same thing too. Like what we, people would typically look at us and be like, oh, they're type A's. They're, you know, they're perfectionists. They always want to do something, you know, to the best degree possible. They're reliable. I know that I'm never going to have to ask them to do something twice. And so this anxiety over under functioning leads us often to over function. And, but that also really takes a toll. And so this kind of came to a head for you initially in 2008. Can you kind of talk about what happened in 2008?
Yes. So in 2008, I was in college. And so, like I've said, I was a very hardworking, high-achieving student. So I did take a lot of AP classes in high school. I'm really looking towards going to a University of California campus. And I did get accepted to UC San Diego and started there in college in 2006. And actually have come to find that it is unfortunately very common, and also something not talked about, that a lot of kids, and I will say kids because even if we're 18, you're still very much
a kid,
and you know, first time being away from home, it can be very mentally detrimental to a lot of people. And for me, I think that being away from home, being in such a rigorous academic environment that was even so far beyond the academic rigor of my high school AP program, and having to take classes that I wasn't interested in, like more like hard sciences and math that are just not really my forte, and just that kind of long open periods of time of freedom away from home and structure, it really was not good for me. I really struggled with that. I had a very hard time motivating myself to get up and go to class and to study, especially for these classes that I wasn't interested in. And the UC San Diego was on a quarter system. So that means that each quarter is only 10 weeks. So it seems like when you start a class, you're already behind. Like I couldn't catch up in calculus, and I failed a class for the first time in my life. And that had a major, major detrimental effect on my identity and self-esteem. And also, you know, struggling to make new friends and social aspect, it's really hard to just leave home and go to another environment. When also, again, as I said, I had these mental health conditions that were never diagnosed or treated when I was a child or teen. So they really emerged in a much more severe way in the first 2 years of college, when I was living in the dorm and then living in an apartment with a friend. I really started to have even more obsessions and compulsions around like cleanliness and organization and scheduling and time, and my skin picking increased. I started to have more panic attacks, which I had never had before. And then I also became more and more depressed and was actually self-harming at that time as well. So I was engaging in a lot of very unhealthy behaviors and having a really hard time coping. I did start to see a therapist for the very first time when I was 18, and also started to take some medication for depression and anxiety. But unfortunately, just into my second year of college as well, I just was not able to stay on track with, you know, the academic part or just, you know, taking care of myself. And actually in the very end of 2007, my best friend at the time and my mom kind of came to me and were basically telling, like, a mini intervention, kind of like, hey, we're very concerned about you. You're not doing well in, you know, any of these aspects, engaging in some unsafe behaviors. Like, they said that they really thought I should take some time off from school to get more help, to get more treatment. And so I did. I ended up leaving UC San Diego and coming home, going into some intensive treatment, and then more like outpatient treatment, while I then finished my bachelor's degree at Cal State Northridge and lived at home, which was just a much better environment for me to feel safe and be able to cope and start to just really work on myself and my goals. Whereas being in San Diego, unfortunately for me at that time, was just really not healthy or productive. And I just didn't have the appropriate coping skills to be able to stay on track while I was there.
So was it in 2008 that you first got a diagnosis of depression, anxiety, and obsessive compulsive disorder?
So that actually was in the fall of 2006. So when I first went to UCSD, I heard about the psychological center there for students, mm-hmm. where, you know, it was pretty much free mental health services. And so I one day mustered up the courage to walk in there and ask if I could have, I didn't have any idea what I was doing or about any diagnoses or anything. I'm just like, man, I feel like I need help.
Yeah.
And so I end up seeing a therapist and psychiatrist through them. And that's when they told me, like, okay, these are these diagnoses that we believe that you have struggled with for a long time, but now we can actually get you some help.
And so, you know, you went home, you know, finished up your undergrad at Northridge. Did you do your grad at Northridge too? Remind me.
No, then I got my master's degree at Cal State Los Angeles.
Okay. And then your PhD at Endicott College.
Correct.
Yes. Okay. Okay. I just want to make sure that I have all of the appropriate.
You're good.
You know, because you're smarty, Allison. I want to give you all of the credit.
Thank you.
And so we're going to just kind of like fast forward from that time until the beginning of 2020. And
yes,
to kind of fill in the gap, it's like you went to college, you went to graduate school, you obtained your master's degree, your PhD, you are continuing, you know, to excel in your career. And these issues and challenges are never resolved, because that's not how mental health issues work.
Exactly.
But you establish a really great relationship with a therapist. And so at the beginning of 2020, you've had the same therapist at that point for what, 8 years, 9 years?
8 years. Yes.
Okay. Correct. So awesome relationship with therapist. You have a really great job that you feel very passionately about. You have an assistant, you know, professor appointment at a university. You had recently finished your PhD. You're publishing some work. You're, you know, getting invited to talks. You're serving on boards within the behavior analytic community. Like, you are living your best life. You're living your best life. So, and then COVID happens.
Yes.
And
I feel it's so cliche, but I think it's like so actually so relevant, and probably everyone does have some sort of story about how COVID has affected them. Of course,
not cliche at all, Allison. Yeah. Like, it's real. Like, yeah. Holy shit. All of us were like, literally, you know, like, I remember like hearing this stuff like start to come out like of China, like in January.
Yeah.
I took my family to Hawaii. And I think I told you this. I took my family to Hawaii for like President's Day week. And a couple of people were like, oh, are you nervous about flying? And there were not that many tourists coming in from Asia.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I'm not really worried about it. And we were in lockdown in California 4 weeks later.
Well, 4 weeks later. Yeah, I actually, another reason that 2020 started off great is because I went on this amazing trip to India and Nepal. Mm-hmm. And because international travel became like a huge hobby and interest of mine. So I was
Yeah.
planning like a really big international trip every year. And so I went on this trip in February, and I came back, I believe, only 2 weeks before, like, COVID really hit. When I went in the beginning of February, and when I even was at LAX at that time, people were only concerned if you were coming from China or going to China. And otherwise, they're like, oh, we don't, what is this COVID thing?
Yeah, whatever, it's
and
fine. Yeah.
I'm so lucky that I made it back into the country, because I feel like it could have really gone the other way with just the timing of it. And I'm so lucky that I was able to go on that trip. It really was like the best memory of 2020. But yeah, things changed very quickly.
Well, and I think for most of us, and especially, you know, because I was in the Bay Area, you were in LA, the first kind of couple months of COVID was like, okay, like we're all mm-hmm. going to, you know, kind of do what we need to do. Everyone's going to kind of shut down, especially there were, you know, within our field, I mean, a lot of people initially were like, oh my gosh, what is going to happen? But then people started helping people, you know, people that got a little more rhythm into what's kind of going on. There were some, you know, programs rolled out by the federal and state government that really helped support people. There was, I feel like, this real rallying cry in our industry to try to provide as much information, free information, access to it, as much, you know, kind of supports as possible. So like we were kind of doing it. And then what happened, especially in LA, and I know this because I was in LA, is everything started to open up at the end of June, and then the shit hit the fan. Yes. And all the numbers started to spike. There, you know, were more, you know, more infections, you know, more deaths. And so things basically shut down again. And for people that do not understand the weather patterns of Los Angeles and also the Bay Area, our hottest weather usually is, it's not June and July. It's like August, September, and October is when it's really hot. And so picture it, you know, we've passed those like first couple of months of like, oh, we're all in this together. Stay home for the everybody. Yay. We love our, you know, health workers. Everyone's so supportive to like, oh, cool. We're getting released from this. But like, wait, not yet. We'll just back it down. And so for you, by summer 2020, you were really starting to decompensate. Can you kind of talk about what was going on for you?
Yeah, exactly. So I think for me, it was a combination of being isolated from friends and family, and also not being able to have the in-person connection with students and clients and kids that normally I thrive on, and so many of us do. Multiple trips being canceled, so not able to travel, and also with that, not able to see friends and have more human connection. Doing so much just sitting on Zoom, you know, like so many of us are doing all the time, teaching, working, conferences on Zoom. Again, more idle and stagnant, but also, again, missing that actual direct human contact. And for me, it's really interesting. I think I told you this because I've always said that I'm I'm a complete introvert and I don't need to have that much social interaction. And I was so shocked that it hit me so hard with not having face-to-face human interaction. I thought that I'd be fine with Zoom because at least you still do get to see people and talk to people, but it really affected me negatively. And so I think that over the summer and into the fall, I just completely threw myself into work and really lost sight of myself and my own needs and wants, which really led to feeling more anxious and depressed, more negative and just darker thoughts. And
what happened the day before Labor Day?
Oh yeah. Okay. So the day before Labor Day was really one of the turning points for me. And I don't know exactly why that day was the most difficult day, except for the fact that it was, I believe, about 115 degrees. And we were in basically a firestorm. Mm-hmm. The entire West Coast was living in...
on fire. I mean, it was
basically
awful.
Basically on fire.
It was awful.
And, you know, my friends and I were checking the air quality index every day. Like, is it better? Is it better? It's really bad air quality, very smoggy and smoky out. And I think it was so it was a Sunday the day before Labor Day. I was severely depressed. And honestly, that is when some of my suicidal thoughts began to emerge. I reached out to my therapist and she said, okay, you need to get out of your house. It was maybe around 4 or 5 p.m. She's like, it's still light out. You need to get out of your house. Like, go right now. Take your dog, my dog Scooby. And
Scooby!
Sarah loves Scooby.
I love Scooby.
So she's like, take Scooby in the car and just drive, go for a drive. So I did. I'm like, okay, I'm just going to do it because I usually listen to what she tells me. and we went driving north and then into like Ventura County and around. And it was so hot. We had the air blasting and I was driving and crying. And part of me wanted to drive off a cliff. And part of me knew I wouldn't do that because I had Scooby with me. And it was just a very, very dark moment, but also one of the turning points of, I think, the first moment that I started to have a seed in the back of my head that something was wrong. Like, I wasn't doing well. I wasn't, you know, living in a healthy manner. For September, October, and then into November, my mood and my anxiety did get increasingly worse, as well as just continuing to have less and less hope for a better future, a happier future, or really any sort of future for myself. And probably around October, my therapist started to mention to me about going to more intensive treatment. And I immediately said no. I just said, nope. I can never do that. That can never happen. I have responsibilities. I can't leave my job. I can't leave my students. Like, where would my dog go?
Because you have all these like self-imposed rules. You're like, I am my job. This is what I do. No one can survive without me. I have to be here. Like, this is, you know, you're resigning yourself to just be unhappy alone, but you're doing the work. And so that's just kind of what you're here to do.
Exactly. Yes. I basically felt that my purpose in life was to help out other people. So whether that be the kids I work with or my students or even friends and family and my dog, like, I'm here to help them. And that's what my purpose in life is. Even if I was completely ignoring my own wants and needs, like, I wasn't exercising, I wasn't eating well. And into November, I was barely eating at all some days. I didn't feel hunger and I just was in this like state of fight or flight, like overdrive. And I was taking a lot of medication to even sleep at night. It was very unhealthy, but when I was in it in that moment, I felt like, well, I'm still working. I'm still teaching. I'm still getting up every morning. I'm fine. I can survive. This is just how my life is.
Yeah. And I think that that's like the biggest misconception with like mental health issues is that depression and anxiety doesn't necessarily manifest in like you're not leaving your house, you're not getting out of bed. Like, you were still into the outside world and to people that maybe didn't necessarily know you, like, functioning. Yes. You know, and that's why, you know, even like when we were talking about like what we were going to call this episode, I was like, I want to call this the PhD with two chronic mental health conditions, because like that is, because that's real. Like, you are smart as fuck. You are, you know, achieving so many things and so many people look up to you. And also, this is true that you have, and, you know, have been incredibly, you know, have so much incredible struggle with depression and anxiety and OCD. And that is, and you're all of those things. And so I think for some people that think like, oh, well, people are depressed, you can definitely tell. I'm here to tell you, you can't. I was like depressed through most of 2020, but like if I'm presenting or having a meeting, people are just like, Sarah, thank you. You're so on top of things. You're so punctual. You're so dedicated. And I think you and I are the same way. Cause I'm like, well, of course, because this is a compensatory strategy. Yeah. Because if I throw myself into work and if I fill my day with all of these things and I tell myself the narrative that I have to get this done, and if I don't do it, no one can, then this is my purpose. Because if I allow myself the space to actually sit and think, I will become overcome with depression and crippling anxiety.
Yeah, 100%. And that was really what was happening to me come like mid-November, is I was working so much. And when I finally would go home or stop working at the end of the day, I was just crying. It was just like an emotional release of all these things that I was trying not to feel and trying to just ignore. Like you said, by working, by being there for other people, even just like talking to friends and trying to be there for them, because many of my friends also had very tough years and lost people they love. And so I would just try to be there for them. And so I didn't have to sit with myself and sit with my thoughts, because my thoughts were, my head was not a good place to be.
Yeah.
Very dark, very hopeless. And
so let's talk about the Saturday group therapy hair appointment. Oh, yes. So that, cause this is like ultimately what really convinced you that like, I have to change something up here.
Oh yes. Okay. Yeah. So I believe it was maybe the first Saturday in November. And it just all came to a head for me. I think like I said, I did think that I could sustain this way of life for many more months, but, I realized that I wasn't able to. I joined, my therapist has a group session on Saturdays, and it's like eight of us girls, and we're all really close. We have a group text. It's so supportive and amazing. And I, when I logged into the group session on that Saturday in November, I just immediately started bawling and I couldn't stop. I couldn't even speak. Every time someone tried to talk to me or tried to unmute, because it is on Zoom as well, I literally couldn't speak. And it ended up being the day that I went to get my hair done, because my therapist was working with me on doing like three things out of my routine just for myself. And I did agree to do those three things, even though they were difficult for me to commit to. One of them was getting my carpets cleaned, professionally cleaned, which did make a difference with my
old
carpet. One of them was to get my nails done, and I got bright purple nail polish. And then the other was to get my hair cut and dyed. And so that was the day of that appointment. I somehow, you know, of course, pulled it together, went to the hair appointment, looked totally fine. I don't know, maybe my eyes were a little red, but, you know, I'm talking to the hairstylist, going out, doing totally fine. Come back home. I'm loving my new hair. It's super awesome. But then I have my individual session with my therapist and immediately break down again. And I'm like, oh my God, what is happening to me? Like, what is, this is, I think I finally said to her, like, this is too much. I can't do this. And she was like, thank you, Lord, for finally believing what I've been telling you. she's like, you need to go to inpatient treatment. And that was not the first time at all that she had said that to me. But it was the first time that I gave in and said, okay, like, okay, I will go. I'm terrified beyond belief. I don't know what this is going to mean. There's so many things to work out, figure out, but I will go. Because it was basically that, or I didn't know if I was going to still be alive, or she was going to basically admit me to a hospital. And I did not want that. So to be able to have a little more control over it, I did let her know that I would agree to go to the treatment center.
And I remember you reaching out and talking to me about this. And of course, you know, in like typical Allison fashion, you were like, I don't know how this is going to go with work. And I'm not sure. And are they going to be compassionate? And I was like, are you kidding me right now? I was like, I know who you work for, and who you work for is a tremendous person. And that person loves you and wants you to do well. And that person's going to be willing to extend whatever you need for you to live, be your best self. Like, trust me, like everyone has your back here. And you're like, I'm not sure. And I would like to say for the record, I was right. Because your place of work totally was supportive for you. But one thing I want to talk about, and something that you and I talked about last week, and this makes me really pissed off, is what you had to do and what you had to sacrifice from a financial perspective in order to go to the treatment center that you selected. So you selected a treatment center in San Diego.
Yes.
And part of that was because it was affordable. And that's because your insurance, of which is like good insurance, covered a fraction.
A teeny tiny fraction.
Yeah. So you talk us through, so let people know, like, where did you find the money to pay for this? How much did you pay? Because also I want this podcast to serve as a call to action that this is nonsense. This is nonsense. What you had to do to be order in order to obtain effective treatment for yourself.
Yes, exactly. So, I looked at many different treatment centers throughout LA and into Orange County and San Diego, and The one that I found in San Diego, one, it is one of the only ones in the entire country, this is another ridiculous thing, that focuses solely on mental health, not addiction. Almost every treatment center, especially in Los Angeles, works with addicts. It's detox, addiction recovery, 12 steps. There are very, very, very few that work with people without addiction, or that addiction is not their primary reason for coming to treatment. The treatment center that I found, they said I was like the ideal patient, basically, because struggling with, you know, mental illness, but able to function and not struggling with addiction. But there's very, very few places like that, unfortunately. It's really, really sad. And this place was much cheaper than most other places that I could find. And unfortunately, my insurance, which, like you said, it is a good insurance with a major insurance company, barely cover any of the cost. So the money that I had worked really hard to save a lot of money for a down payment, because I really wanted to buy property, a condo or townhome somewhere in Los Angeles. And I spent that entire amount of money, $22,000, on treatment.
And that only got you 5 weeks of inpatient treatment. And you would have stayed, and you would wanted to stay longer, but it just simply was totally and utterly unaffordable.
Correct. I would have liked to stay another week or two at least. And I do think there was definitely more therapeutic work that I could have done there, but I didn't have any other dime to give them. So obviously I needed to have some small amount of money to survive on when I came home. And I was, you know, of course, still paying my rent and all that. So it was very limiting. My insurance was not helpful in getting me access to the treatment.
Yeah. And I just find this infuriating because, again, there's mental health parity laws, which say that mental health disorders should be treated on par with medical disorders. But, you know, as with everything in our healthcare system, the devil is in the details. And so thinking that you were having a crisis in this, you know, having an acute event, and basically it was like, get into inpatient treatment or run the risk that you might carry out suicide. I mean, that's where you were at. And so in order for you to access effective treatment, you had to drain your savings that you were using to buy a home. But you felt like there was no other choice. What are you going to like go into like massive debt? There's no family members that can afford to do this. No. And so I just, you know, I'm so glad that you had the ability to do that. But also at the same time, I feel very strongly people shouldn't have to make those types of choices. And it's just, it infuriates me, but I'm grateful that you did, because I get to talk to you now about it. And obviously, yes. You know, I think there's, you know, I've just seen such this radical shift with you as a result of having this time in San Diego. Can you just kind of describe, and this is where we can really kind of talk about how behavioral science has been a really great and effective part of your, you know, whole total treatment package.
Yes.
What did you do in San Diego? What were the treatment approaches? Like talk about it. Cause I know that what I really liked is that it was very holistic.
Yes.
And there was a lot of intersectionality across, mm-hmm. you know, kind of like Western medicine, Eastern medicine. And it was really, you know, when you were talking to me about this initially, when you came home, I was like, oh my gosh, this sounds like awesome. Because it was.
Yes, it really was. Obviously, very hard work therapeutically, work, you know, a lot of hard days, crying, difficult times. But overall, it was such an amazing experience that I do not regret for a moment taking that time for myself, even though it was probably one of the most difficult things that I have ever done, making that decision and going through the process of making all the plans for leaving work and leaving my house, my dog, and you know, going down there for X amount of time. The holistic approach was really something I was looking for. Obviously, as a scientist and behavior analyst, I definitely was looking for some evidence-based treatments. And I did a lot of different types of therapy, such as acceptance commitment therapy, which is rooted in behavior analysis, cognitive behavioral therapy, really working on the thought processes. So challenging and reframing negative thoughts to be more positive or at least more realistic. And then dialectical behavior therapy, which looks at a lot of distress tolerance skills. So when we are faced with difficult emotions or difficult situations, how do we react? And what are more effective adaptive coping mechanisms to handle these stressful situations or situations that may cause a panic attack or severe depression or a crying episode or something like that? How do we deal with that? DBT also works on mindfulness and being in the moment. And that was something that I really focused on, trying to just quell the anxiety and just be present and enjoy the current moment rather than always thinking five steps ahead. And also works on some more like emotional regulation and interpersonal effectiveness skills. So how to regulate how we feel, and also really the intersectionality between our thoughts, our feelings, and our behavior, our overt behaviors. And that is a very, you know, behavior analytic approach. So that part I was doing both individual and group therapy. Also did some meditation and yoga, which I've incorporated into my daily life here as well, back at home. I also did biofeedback, which is really, really awesome. You're basically hooked up to these different like heart monitors and doing some specific individualized type of deep breathing for a period of time, like maybe a 10-minute interval. And the coolest thing is that there's immediate data that is shown on the screen about your own level of your heart rate variability and your oxygen levels and how many breaths you're taking per minute, your heart rate. And so I got this really awesome pre and post data analysis and graphs at the end. And of course, like as a behavior analyst, I'm like nerding out over, like I feel like the other patients were like, oh yeah, it's cool, whatever. And me and the biofeedback,
you're like, this is amazing.
Yeah, like I'm sitting with the biofeedback therapist like, oh my God, look at this and this. And he was loving it. He thought he was really glad that I was into it. And I basically saw that my heart rate variability and like my oxygen levels when I came into treatment were really bad. Like he was like, how are you alive? Basically, I was basically hyperventilating all the time, but I didn't realize it. And at discharge, I was taking a lot of deep breaths and my heart rate variability was a lot grander and a lot better and a lot healthier. And the deep breathing practice is also something that I have been continuing to work on every day. And some of the other aspects of treatment in San Diego that were just really helpful to me were, I mean, of course, being removed from daily life, it eliminates stress and just allows someone to be more in the moment and be more connected with personal goals. So I was able to focus more on getting back my appetite and starting to eat healthy and make healthy eating choices, walking more and hiking and being in nature, being in the sun every day, going to the beach, and also a lot more personal connection. Because I was living at the treatment center with about 12 or 13 other people and in group therapy with those people as well. So you become very close very quickly. It's a very interesting dynamic. But like I said, when I was so isolated, I was able to be around other people and develop new social connections, which was so critical for me.
So you said, I mean, I remember because I talked to you, I want to say like within what, like a couple days or no, you texted me, I think when you were like the first day or the second day you were home.
I text you when like the day before I was coming home.
Oh yeah, you were like, yeah, you're like, I am coming home. And I was like, yes. Okay, we need to talk. Oh, right. And then I was like, okay, let's make a date and let's talk about all this. And it was just so interesting because, you know, just talking to you prior and then being able to talk to you after, it was like, it's like there was this like just like lightness to you and in our interaction. And not to say that like, you know, in any way, shape, or form, like you're magically cured, Allison. And now that you've spent these 5 weeks in San Diego, you never have to worry about depression and anxiety ever again.
Oh,
but
I wish.
More just like how critical that reset was. And also just to have, because you know this again, we're both behavior analysts, just to have the opportunity to work on habituating some of these like positive habits. And frankly, also just to have, you know, have that connection, I think I told you, like, I've been obsessed with this book by Johan Hari called Lost Connections.
Yes.
And it's this deep dive.
It came in the mail. I'm going
to
read it.
Oh, my God. You have to read it, and then we're going to have to talk about it. Because you're literally, like, every page, you're going to be like, yes. And then you're going to turn the page, and you're going to be like, yes. And what's fascinating about this book is it doesn't talk about behavior analysis specifically, but everything that he's talking about is behavior analytic, because it's looking at how our environment affects us and basically saying, like, hey, there's a reason why there are more people that are depressed and anxious, and, like, you know, the Western world, especially looking at the United States and the UK specifically, than there ever has been before. And it's all because of our environment, right? And just talking about the research that supports the deep connections with people, shared purpose, that supports control in the work that you do and being able to see a future, that supports understanding that we're part of this larger ecosystem and the power of being out in nature, the power of moving our bodies, that supports the mindfulness practice. And there's so much research to back this up in the behavioral, you know, science field. And yeah, so I can't wait for you to read that. And it's so interesting because basically everything that you were doing is just kind of echoed in this book. And so I think so many people think, you know, like, what's wrong with me? Like, why can't I just shake this? But it's like, no, like, as behavior analysts, we know that we're products of our environment. And, you know, having some type of, like, different chemical imbalance or really truly experiencing, like, depression and anxiety in a very specific way in your brain is a real thing. But there are so many things going on in our environment that also absolutely and utterly contribute to how we feel. And if we can really kind of hone in, like, on what are those specific, you know, kind of environmental, you know, features that we can either change or reframe, this is just, like, it's so empowering. And that's really what I kind of felt like from you, is you were just like, this happened, you know. I mean, even the fact that we've been able to talk through this conversation and talk about these hard things, and it's not to say that you have to, like, be in tears or, you know, totally emotional about it, but you can be connected to the experience, but the experience doesn't have to, like, take over everything. Does that make sense?
Totally. 100%.
Yeah. And so just, like, I am just so grateful that you were able to do this, because I just see, like, I can feel, even, like, through our stupid Zooms, because we're still in COVID and no one can see each other, you know, it's just, like, it's palpable. And so I know that you, I mean, because, again, part of our, you know, conversation with this was really kind of talking about, like, okay, when we wrap this up, like, what are the points, the biggest key kind of takeaways that we're hoping that people have from this? And I know that you have some, so I want to give you the opportunity to, you know, really kind of, like, drive those points home, because they're really good.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah. So I think that some of the main things that I've taken away from this experience, 2020 as a whole, and also treatment, is kind of a new way of life that I want to continue to enact throughout 2021 and future years. And I'm really working on being grateful. And you and I talked about this, gratitude being so critical to a healthy life, a healthy mindset. That aspect of mindfulness and being in the moment, taking one thing at a time, one day at a time. Like, I'm really committed to multitasking less, which is hard for me because I always will say that I'm, like, really, really good at multitasking, but it leads to me feeling more anxious. It increases my level of like anxiety, puts me into that fight or flight mode, and it's just not healthy or necessary to be doing that. So I'm really trying to be mindful of that, and also just generally mindful of situations that arise in daily life that are kind of triggers for me to feel more anxious or stressed. And not that in any way anyone can ever eliminate stress from their life or eliminate, you know, every situation that might be a trigger. But I just at least want to be more aware of it so I can kind of have a game plan, like with the deep breathing or yoga or going on a walk. Or I've also been incorporating more positive affirmations into my daily practice, saying them and reading them on an app that I have called I Am, which is a really awesome app that just has millions of positive affirmations in it. I wrote some on Post-its, put them around my house, and just have more positive thinking. I also realized more the actual importance of personal connection and a support system, being accountable to each other, having open and honest communication, and taking care of each other, but also taking care of ourselves is really so critical to have time for ourselves so that we are able to do better for other people. And I didn't realize this before. Like I said, I thought that I could just give and give and give and give, and that was enough. That was what I was supposed to be doing. And I realized that I feel like I've been more productive and more in tune with my clients and students and friends and family since I've been back than I was before when I was giving my all to them, because I was running on empty and I was basically depleting myself. Whereas now, when I have a better balance of, you know, working really hard and doing my best, but then also having a break, going home and relaxing and doing things that I enjoy and going to the beach and going hiking and meditating and having just more healthy, balanced life, it really does allow me to be actually more there for other people and be a better, you know, clinician and professor and friend and family member.
I just want to also discuss the fact that you bought a new couch, and this was like a whole theme between you and I
through the
majority of 2020. Cause you were just like, I hate this apartment. I hate this couch. I've had the same couch for forever. You know, it just, it's horrible. I'm at home. I hate looking at it. And I was like, Al, like, girl, go on Amazon. Like, do you want me to pick out some couches for you? Do you, like, I'm down. Like, let's change up this environment. And you're like, And then, you know, kind of as the fall kind of, you know, continued to kind of march on, you were just like, I can't do it. I'm doing other stuff. And, you know, obviously this coincided with you, you know, just kind of really feeling more, you know, more depressed and anxious. But you got the new couch now.
Yes. So, yes, it was a theme for a long time that I was telling so many people that I was going to buy a new couch and I never did. And I feel like people were just getting super annoyed at me about it. Like, why are you even talking about this? And for some reason, it just felt like an insurmountable task for me. In the fall, when I was really struggling, like even something like taking out the trash was very difficult sometimes to just like find the energy. So buying a new couch and worrying about getting delivered and all that, like it just seemed too difficult. And when I came back from in a few weeks ago in the beginning of January, feeling so much better, I'm like, okay, I'm going to do these things that I was not due for myself last year as part of like self-care. And so I just like went on Living Spaces and I'm like, this couch, and I bought it and got it delivered. And it's so, I feel so happy about it. Like it's more than just a couch. It's just, it is very symbolic in terms of how long this process had been going on. So it's definitely like a sign that I'm able to commit to more things that are even something as simple as that. Like you said, it's just, it changes something in my environment where, you know, we all have been spending so much time in our homes, and just a little thing like that, or that I've gotten some plants, or I have now like an essential oil diffuser, or I have more candles, like little things like that. It really has made a difference in my home environment feeling more warm and welcoming while I still have to be here and spend so much time sitting here at this table.
Yeah. And then when we were FaceTiming, then you got to show it off to me.
Yes.
And exactly. I was like, oh my gosh. And that's when I was like, that $22,000 was definitely worth it, Allison, just for me to see you and Scoob chilling on the new couch. Yeah. I was like, worthwhile investment. Okay. Exactly. What was your final kind of thought that you wanted to give everybody?
Yeah. So one of the reasons that I did agree to do this podcast with you, Sarah, is because I think that we need to be talking about this more. We need to be talking about mental health, and especially now in the midst of the pandemic, because we really are more alike than we all think. I do know for a fact that so many people have struggled with mental health difficulties, and I don't, whether you have an actual diagnosis or like on medication or not is pretty actually irrelevant at this time. It's like people who never had any sort of mental health struggle before have struggled this past year and perhaps found themselves in therapy, or even if not, they have had periods of time of being really anxious and stressed and upset about COVID, things on the news about the health and safety of them and their families and their financial situations and jobs and all that. And the problem in society is that mental health is considered something that you don't talk about. It's more taboo. People are a lot less likely to tell their friends, family, coworkers, anyone that they're going to therapy or they have a diagnosis that is psychiatric in nature versus something like that's physical, or if they're having some sort of physical procedure or surgery. You know, you hear about when someone tells you they're sick and they are having surgery or something like that, you know, we send flowers, we want to be helping that person and everything. And people are, first of all, not even as willing to be open about struggling with mental health. And then the way that people respond is just not the same. I really honestly believe that mental health needs to be considered as important and critical as physical health. And that even though I feel a lot better now, but was very terrified to be taking this risk to talk so vulnerably and honestly, I just kept reminding myself that it's so, so necessary, because even if one person listens and starts to open up about their struggle with mental health, it will make a big difference for me. Like, it'll be worth it that I was sharing my story because of that. It's really hard when you have chronic mental illnesses or just these other invisible type of struggles. Because like you said, for you and me, a lot, even people that I know relatively well, when I told them that I was going to treatment, they were like, oh my God, I never would have known. I'm so sorry. I thought that, you know, you always look so put together and you're on top of everything and you're doing all these things. And I would never know that you're struggling. And I think about that in terms of other people in my life. Maybe I don't know that they're struggling because they might be able to put on kind of that same facade, and they might not feel comfortable opening up to let me or other people know that they're struggling with a similar issue. So I just want to open the conversation more about this, because it is, we just need to normalize it just as much as we would talk about if we have a migraine or we broke our leg or we have IBS or any sort of, you know, physical illness that people a lot more easily talk about.
Yeah. I love that you chose IBS. That was really funny.
It's just random. I don't know. I couldn't think of anything.
I'm down to talk about that. I'm down to talk about all of the shit, like literally and figuratively.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. This just randomly came to me.
but seriously, but this is what we want to do. And we want to and we also want to share. There's joy to be had in these conversations. There's laughter that can still be had in these conversations. And just like you have a PhD in two chronic mental health illnesses, you can be all of the things. You can be depressed and you can be functioning. You can be anxious and you can still be, you know, killing it at work. You can be sad and you can still find the humor in things. And that's also where I think sometimes, you know, we tend to, as humans, we like to compartmentalize things and put things in categories. It makes it easier for our brains to process. But I think to the extent that we can start seeing ourselves and allowing ourselves the grace and compassion for first and foremost each other, and you know, and then to be able to do this inwardly, to be able to understand that all of these things are you, and that's what makes you, like, you know, flawed and gorgeous and hilarious and sad, and that is like the beauty of the human experience. And so if we want to be able to experience our whole humanness and allow other people to experience theirs as well and really live out their humanity, then we have to be willing to be able to see all of it and hold it, and be able to work through it together, and to not feel like there are certain things that are, you know, oh, we shouldn't talk about that, or well, you know, successful people don't have those issues, so you should act like you don't, because that's not what real leaders experience. It's like, dude, no, that's just not how life works. So I agree. I hope, Allison, you know, that if just one person is positively impacted by this conversation that we had today, I will feel that is a success. But mostly, I hope for you that you can see and have, you know, tremendous compassion and joy for yourself in terms of having been willing to do the hard work to make these really challenging choices, and then to be able to see and truly find your light at the end of the tunnel, and understand that it's going to be an ongoing process. And girl, I'm here for it. Like, we're friends. We're gonna still be friends.
Let's do it.
When we're allowed to hang out with each other, I'll come down and sit on that new fancy couch with Scooby.
Please.
But this is incredibly vulnerable stuff. And I am, again, so grateful for your willingness to talk about it. And I believe passionately that these conversations are I mean, this is like the good stuff of life and yes. the stuff that we need to be talking about more.
I agree. And thank you so much, Sarah. I probably wouldn't have done this with anyone else. So it's very humbling and special for me.
Girl, same. Thanks for listening to Defy. We really appreciate your support. And we hope that you listen to all of the different podcasts that we've put together. And guess what? We're available on all of the podcast platforms and on social media too. And we even have a website. Like seriously, we have all of that stuff. You can find us at www.defy.community. You can find us on Instagram at defy.comm, on Facebook using the same defy.comm, or you can even send me an email if you just want to chat about something or if you have an idea of a podcast that you think would be really great for our community. Our email is contact@defy.community. We hope that you have found something that you can take away from this podcast that will impact your life. We hope that you continue to defy society's expectations of you. Because remember, baby, well-behaved women rarely make history.